Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Report podcast. I am your host, Austin Peterson, here with my associate editor on his very last day at the Libertarian Republic. Ian, welcome back to the show one last time.
Good to be here.
All right, Ian, so you wrote a very popular column, probably one of the most popular columns in the Libertarian Republic's history, and it was called "Has a Libertarian Society Ever Existed?" And I think that it was obviously perfect timing because Salon wrote an article the day before, like, libertarianism has never existed.
I think it was called "The Question Libertarians Just Can't Answer."
Right.
That headline is probably not totally inaccurate because a lot of libertarians don't know about the great historical precedent for libertarian ideas throughout history.
Right. So you wrote a rebuttal article. It came out perfect timing the day after because everybody wanted to be able to say, I know that libertarianism has existed. And the question itself really is sort of ridiculous because it's like saying, when has your perfect utopian society ever existed? Oh, well, I'm sorry, you know, well, it was the nation of Atlantis, but it sunk into the ocean, you know?
Right, but I don't think libertarians are utopians. I think libertarians want to achieve not some perfect society, but a maximally good society. Given that we live in a world with limitations, what's the best result we can attain? I think that's what libertarians are about.
But remember, a perfect socialist society has existed multiple times, and 90 million people were killed because of it.
Right, I think you have an excellent rebuttal to the question, when has a libertarian society ever existed? The most obvious response should be, well, when has a socialist society ever existed, or when has a strong centralized government ever existed? Mm-hmm. Plenty of times, and it's always been disastrous. Marxist governments killed 2/3 of everyone killed by governments in the 20th century.
Right. We published an article yesterday on our new sister site, Liberty Viral, called "The Top 10 Things Libertarians Are Tired of Hearing." And one of the things that people told us we left off, which they totally nailed us on, was if you like liberty so much, or if you want to live in a country with no government, go to Somalia. And I like to just joke and say, okay, well, fine. If you want to live in a perfect socialist country, go to North Korea, you know?
Yeah, precisely. Exactly. And we'll have to talk about Somalia here in a minute. But yeah. What I wanted to do with this column is there are a lot of in-depth scholarly examinations of the different societies I looked at and how they employed ideas that modern libertarians would agree with. Mm-hmm. But I had never seen a reference sheet that briefly went through a few of them. And so that's what I try to do in this column. Now, some people pointed out to me I maybe left out some important examples. A historian friend of mine said, hey, this sounds a lot like medieval Anglo-Saxon society. Maybe there's also some precedent there. I got a nice letter from someone who said I should have included Lombard Italy. So these aren't the only examples, but I think that they're good ones.
Right, and you know, people, they sort of criticize libertarianism because when we look at these historical examples of libertarianish societies, they say, oh, well, what, can't you provide a more recent example? And they don't understand that, like, libertarianism in its modern form is a very recent sort of phenomenon. The kind of classical liberalism, as we define it, is really very recent because before liberals, as we understand them, called themselves liberals, the people that we understand as social Democrats or big government type status, they used to call themselves libertarians. So there's a lot of problems with the linguistics here and in the definition of terms. And so when we call ourselves a libertarians, what we really mean are people who want to maximize individual liberty. They believe in economic freedom and personal liberty, such as how we describe it at the Libertarian Republic.
Right. Well, what I try to argue is that libertarianism is really grounded in long-established common sense and is not really this newfangled or innovative idea. For 200,000 years, that's how long humans have existed. For the bulk of that time, we've lived in small communities of 150 to 200 people. Mm-hmm. We've worked together and managed our own internal affairs and apparently survived without cumbersome super states telling us what to do. Those things are really a blip on our history. And so I don't think we're wired to live in them.
So let's talk about your examples here, because I think our listeners are going to find this absolutely fascinating. And this is something they'll be able to use if they're actually interested in an academic debate, a real debate with someone, not just like a sort of war of words.
Well, I should point out that since I am not a historian, for all of these examples in my column, and I will name them as we're going through these options, I cite respected historians and economists to make my point.
Okay, great. So the first example that you use, which I think is really interesting, because I just watched the show Vikings, but perhaps the most familiar example of a historic libertarian order, the Godord, G-O-D-O-R-D, Godord system of old Iceland, has been cited by economist David Friedman and other libertarian thinkers, and is an example of a decentralized legal system. And basically, it was sort of Iceland was founded as something of a 9th century free state project, is how you describe it. You say, according to their own histories, says Carolyn Larrington of St. John's College, the Norwegians migrated from Norway because King Harald Fairhair was centralizing power there. So the creation of Iceland was sort of a flight from overarching government. Can you tell us more?
Right. So the people who moved to Iceland and settled there were the people who valued community, who valued individualism, and who wanted to preserve these values as Harald Fairhair was setting up this centralized authoritarian government. So they wanted to get away from that stuff and preserve their traditional folkways, which are ways that libertarians would find a lot of agreement with in Iceland. And they did that by setting up the Godord system, which was a decentralized legal system made up of several dozen entities.
Interesting. And they're called Godord here. You just define why they're calling Godard.
Godard is a man who leads the Godord. So since there was no kingship, they rejected kingship. A Godard was a man who wanted to be a political and religious leader, but it was understood that he was not entitled to subjects. He had to persuade others to voluntarily follow him. So you could start a Godord and persuade others to join, and they would pay some voluntary dues. In exchange for the dues, you would provide arbitrators to arbitrate between your customers, so to speak, or you would provide lawyers if there were inter-Godord disputes to go and participate in the adjudication of the dispute. Now, it was understood that people could leave a Godord and join another Godord at any time. So this Iceland's about the size of Virginia. There's several dozen of these small chieftaincies. And so what that meant is there was a market for fairness and efficiency in government. If you were a bad Godar, people would join another Godord, and it was widely accepted that people could do this.
And you also said that each chieftaincy collected voluntary taxes.
Precisely,
in the
right.
form of temple dues.
You actually didn't even need to physically leave. You could say, I'm no longer a member of this Godord. I am joining Bob's Godord over there.
Bob's, I'm sure.
Right.
Or like Hralvar's. Okay, so this is a cool example.
And one of the reasons that the Icelandic example is so important, by the way, Roderick Long has made this point, is that this system in Iceland existed for longer than the United States has existed.
Mm-hmm.
So if people say, hey, these examples only lasted for short periods of time, well, you think that the present United States system is sustainable, apparently, if you're someone who's criticizing me for pointing to these historical precedents.
Right.
So the Icelandic system lasted longer.
All right. So let's look at the next one. I think this is
called HEER, by the way.
Okay, HEER, not ZEER. It's because it's spelled X-E-E-R. HEER. Okay, so Ian writes, it's strikingly similar to the Godord scheme. The HEER system likewise flourished for at least hundreds of years in what is today the state of Somalia, where it still persists in the rural north. So the system differs in that membership in one's clans or kabil is fixed at birth, but it does afford greater competition between private courts or gurti. These courts, which traditionally meet beneath acacia trees, are financed by donations from local businessmen. For the businessmen, these donations serve as a kind of advertisement. That's very interesting, but doesn't that mean that all the rich businessmen own the courts?
Precisely, it does. Well, it's interesting because they don't get a profit benefit directly from financing these private courts.
Mm-hmm.
What they gain is reputation. It's advertisement for their business if they donate to a private court. So I think a lot of times when people criticize libertarians for, you know, relying too much on human goodness and charity and setting up a welfare system, really we're not, because you can get a lot of that stuff done through self-promotion. In ancient Rome, long after the patrician plebeian system stopped being useful in terms of electoral success, it was still going on. People were still collecting money from their patricians just because it was a status symbol for the patrician to have all these clients that were dependent on them and relied on their aid. So businessmen will make donations like this to promote themselves.
Interesting. All right. So
now, one thing that's interesting about here is that its legal lexicon doesn't have any loan words. So it didn't come, you know, the here system and the Icelandic system, even though they're very similar, apparently didn't just get culturally transmitted from one place to another. It looks like each group came up with their own system independently. So what that suggests to me is that there is an intuitive human legal order that we know on a common sense basis that people should be able to manage their own internal affairs in their own communities, and that faraway bureaucrats shouldn't be doing that for us.
Mm-hmm. Now, your next example kind of raises the eyebrows, I think, when you say, I mean, you use a sort of benign term to describe it, but what you're really saying is the Holy Roman Empire here.
Well, I say...
called Carolingian law.
Carolingian law, I say Carolingian law, because instead of Carolingian Empire here, as my example, because Charlemagne, in terms of his foreign policy, was a terrorist. I should be totally frank about that.
So and he was a domestic libertarian, foreign neocon.
Yes, I think that not only was Charlemagne a war criminal, but unfortunately I think one act committed by Charlemagne, the massacre at Verdun, is probably the worst act motivated by Christianity in the history of Christendom.
Fantastic.
Unfortunately.
Very interesting.
And so that is obviously a downside to his overall legacy. But the domestic system of Carolingian law, which was very successful, was very laissez-faire.
You compare him to Ronald Reagan.
Right. I compare him to Ronald Reagan because Ronald Reagan was not a non-interventionist, really. I don't think he's a great example of non-interventionism.
Right.
You know, sent troops to Lebanon and so on. But domestically, was relatively laissez-faire. That's sort of how Charlemagne was, only on a more extreme level. He was off waging this campaign of terrorism against the Saxons. But domestically, he had a very laissez-faire legal system, and that led to him being one of the most successful imperial leaders in European history, and also allowed for a Carolingian renaissance of intellectual revival, of poetry, and linguistics, and so forth.
So you say internally that the Holy Roman Empire was sort of a loose confederation of small principalities that were encouraged to retain contradictory sets of laws, kind of like America.
Well, not like America, because America has presently become a top-down system whereby the federal government has the most power.
I know.
The states have less power than that, and localities...
But we do have some contradictory laws.
Localities have less power. So that flip that on its head, and you get the Carolingian legal system. So the London historian Tom Asbridge says that, right, it was a loose conglomeration of powers, and he also thinks we should apply this to modern times. He says, there's a lesson for us to learn about Europe, the EU... Charlemagne's way of diversity and unity is perhaps the way forward. Allow people to create competing legal systems in different areas that are accountable to localities and actually understand the people that they're governing because they're close to them instead of far away. That creates a market for efficiency, a market for fairness. It allows for more success. Here's another reason why it's important to bring up Carolingian law, I think. A big hang-up I run into with maybe people who are a bit neocon-leaning about libertarianism, is they say, you know, I like liberty and all that. I like what you're saying, but I'm very patriotic and I want to live in a great, glorious nation, and so I need some big government programs to do that. Well, the Carolingian Empire was very successful. Charlemagne was an extremely successful conqueror, but domestically had a laissez-faire system. The Roman Empire reached its height under the Emperor Trajan. It reached its maximum extent, and Trajan, besides letting up on religious persecution, would actually tell local governments when they asked him for advice, I'm not going to deal with this. You guys manage your own internal affairs. You know your subjects better than I do, so you have to adjudicate this issue.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that when we have successful and durable large-scale powers, it's because they're domestically laissez-faire and because they allow for local governments to have autonomy.
Interesting. So the next example that you use, which is very interesting too, is the hoplite farmer. And you talk about Donald Kagan, who's a respected Greek scholar, talking about a lecture that he gave. where he talks about Cypselus, and he says that Cypselus, like just about all the tyrants, used his power to do something the Greek governments normally did not do, namely collect taxes from their people. And then you say, you have to understand the idea of taxation being normal.
This is Donald Kagan I'm quoting. And Donald Kagan, by the way, is one of the most respected scholars of Greek history living in the world.
You say, you have to understand, the idea of taxation being normal would have gotten a Greek foaming at the mouth.
Right, these are Kagan's words.
When there's no tyranny, there's no taxation. The normal form of taxation that existed in the Greek world when it is in its independent polis phase was simply customs duties on trade, so sort of a sales tax. But the hoplite farmer wasn't going to be taxed. Paying taxes is what barbarians did to their kings, a very powerful feeling.
Right, that was all a direct quote from Donald Kagan,
not
me.
Tell us about this.
So, right, the Greek society at this time was, as Kagan indicated, a set of independent polities. There wasn't, you know, a Greek empire going on. The different cities just managed their own internal affairs. Everyone learns about, you know, Sparta and Athens competing with each other and so on. So because there were all of these independent powers, what it did is it created a market, like I indicated in previous examples. If one polity was leveling heavy taxes on its people, then the subjects in that polity could move to another one because you had a series of local governments managing their own internal stuff. And consequently, we saw a society where people weren't taxed unless you were engaged in trade, then you were charged customs duties. So it is really an ahistorical idea to levy these heavy taxes on your own people. And when someone says, this is just the way the world works, this is the way it's always been, that is not the case. Obviously, we look to Greece as a very successful civilization, got a lot done in terms of scholarship and philosophy and so on, and yet they did it without anything remotely resembling our present system of taxation, let alone a centralized overarching government.
So talk to me. I mean, people like to say the United States is libertarian, but we have a system. We have a progressive income tax. We have foreign interventionism abroad. What do you think about the United States? Is the United States a libertarian society, Ian?
Well, one thing that is incredibly libertarian about the United States is the First Amendment. Americans have no idea how important the First Amendment is, I think, and really how grateful we should be that we have something like it, let alone a Bill of Rights. A lot of European countries today that we look to as other civilized states don't have a First Amendment. In Britain,
even for example, states that are more economically free.
Right. So in Britain, which we look to as being sort of like us, you can regularly read about, if you check the Daily Mail, for instance, people being arrested for speech crimes and for silly speech crimes. Not too long ago, there was a schoolgirl in Britain who was arrested and locked in a cell when her teacher called the police on her. And what she did was said, I can't understand any of the other girls in this group that I've been assigned to because they speak, I think it was only Pashtun maybe, or they were Uyghurs or something like that. She just said, I can't understand them. The teacher thought she was saying something racially insensitive and called the cops, and this girl was locked in a cell.
Unbelievable.
So that's something that would never happen in the United States because thank God we have a First Amendment. Americans really don't understand how valuable that is.
Well, and so the Second Amendment, good Lord. I mean, like, right. You can't own a gun in Britain either.
Right, and there are some European countries where they have more lax gun rights. But the First Amendment is incredibly unique and relatively little precedent for something that explicit historically.
A much smarter man than I once said that it is the natural tendency for government to grow and for liberty to shrink. I think that, you know, the United States, as it was founded, the original Constitution was very libertarian, except for the whole slavery thing, obviously.
And a lot of the framers were anti-slavery and would have liked to do away with that.
Benjamin Franklin, mm-hmm. Very much. He founded the first anti-slavery group in Massachusetts, I believe, or excuse me, in Pennsylvania.
That's right, I believe so.
So it's interesting to me, you know, that libertarians, we give America such a hard time, and deservedly so, but the country is very libertarian in many ways. You know, the Bill of Rights is probably the best example, but you're not going to get thrown in prison for saying, you know, things like, I don't understand my Muslim classmates or something like that. And I have a friend from the United Kingdom who complained recently because she's like, we can't even fly the British flag anymore because it's offensive to Muslims. So, you know, you can't go 5 feet in the United States without seeing an American flag here, for sure, and we'll never have that kind of right taken away from us, I don't believe. But, you know, I think that, Ian, you know, it being your last day here, we should talk about your experience a little bit here at the Libertarian Republic, and we should kind of look back a little bit because, you know, the whole goal of the Libertarian Republic is to make these ideas accessible. You know, and I think that you probably wanted to come work here, I'm just guessing, because you saw the Libertarian Republic as a path to building a bigger tent. You know, I'm a secular libertarian. You're a religious conservative libertarian. So tell me, like, why did you want to come work at the Libertarian Republic? What first attracted you to coming here? And tell us a little bit about your experience here. And don't feel like you've got to, like, you know, praise me or something like that. You don't have to. But tell us a little bit about your experience here and what have you learned?
Well, in fact, I was always under the impression that you, while being a secular libertarian and while being outspoken about those beliefs, were open to working with people that had different personal views. And I think that is precisely what we need to build a big tent coalition, people who have different personal moral views and have different preferences, but say, let's unite around our right to have these different preferences. You wouldn't have the right to impose yours on me. I won't have the right to impose mine on yours, and then we can have a persuasive market and come to the right decision that way, as opposed to risking letting one group rig the whole game with force. Also, you have always taken a pragmatic approach to promoting libertarianism and haven't insisted on, you know, my utopia now, so to speak, or nothing. Let's support some politicians that are taking steps in the right direction. And that's important to me also.
Right. I'm very open-minded. I kind of love people, you know. I'm not a libertarian misanthrope who just kind of like wants to be a hermit and get away from the world. I actually genuinely love people, you know.
Right. That's something that is, some libertarians I disagree with on this. I'm really not an individualist in a sense that a lot of libertarians are.
Right.
I tend to, in my rhetoric, be very community-oriented. Mm-hmm. I tend to advocate community alternatives as opposed to the government doing something, where another libertarian might be more quick to think of a private business option.
Right.
I think that we can do things by working together in small groups of neighbors,
right,
of churches, and so on.
Right. And my philosophy of libertarianism is because I think it'll be good for everybody, because I think everybody will be much happier and more prosperous. Because I love people, I want them to be free. You know, this isn't just, like a lot of socialists will accuse us, well, libertarians is like, I got mine, well, and screw you. But that's really not how I feel about things. I really want more people to be free. I want more people to be rich. You know, I really take it upon myself to mentor people like you, Ian, people. I do a lot of volunteering with the Ladies of Liberty, where I spend my weekends teaching them how to get better, and I spend a lot of time doing that because I think that helping other people like, you know, Jack Hunter, give them opportunities and things like that, helping other people is the way to advance these ideas. Because even though libertarianism is sort of accused as being a selfish philosophy, I think that I actually believe in karma, even though I'm not spiritual or anything like that. I believe in the concept of karma, that what you put out there, you will get back. And so the Libertarian Republic is my way of putting the ideas out there in a positive way. And I want to read an email that we got the other day, because I think it was really exciting. It was really interesting. What were you going to say?
Oh, excellent. Well, I should add, yes, that's part of the reason I'm working here, is Austin was my boss when I interned at FreedomWorks and was certainly a mentor to me there. And already in the few months we worked together, definitely had some influence on my worldview. And so I think that naturally led to my coming here and being associate editor.
All right, so let's read an email that somebody wrote to us the other day, which I think he just nailed what we're going for. I won't read his name just in case he wants to be private, but he says, I just wanted to drop you a line to say thank you. I was raised as a staunch Republican, me too, but after serving in Iraq, I came back and started really paying attention to politics. I quickly became sick of the Republican Party and started searching for the truth. I liked the idea of freedom for which I fought, but didn't really understand what freedom meant. I then discovered libertarianism with all its varied incarnations. It was hard for me as a professional to find anyone who truly believed in freedom. I had lots of people in the political left and right who thought of freedom in terms of what you're allowed to do. I didn't like this attitude. It seemed like you had to have a reason to be free. Why should you be allowed to own a gun, and under what circumstances? I started to listen to podcasts and videos from people like Stefan Molyneux, but many of his points seemed too utopian for me. Then I found the Libertarian Republic. I have to say, it really helped me redefine and refine my idea of what it is to be a libertarian. While I do not agree with you 100% of the time, I find that your arguments are almost exclusively easy to understand and apply to topics which I had previously struggled with. Thank you for putting this resource out there to help those like myself who love freedom and are trying to internally define what freedom is and why it is important. Now, isn't that exactly what we're
going
for?
That's precisely what we're going for. And, of course, there's room for people that, you know, are a bit more esoteric and high-minded. But then you also need people who think about how do we actually apply this stuff and focus on that in their outreach. What is the practical application here? How do we get a step closer to this society?
All right, Ian, well, is there anything else you'd like to say to our readers before you go?
Well, it's been a great pleasure.
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You know that you're listening to this podcast probably because this guy sitting across from me, this hero of liberty, Ian Hewitt, is the guy who brought you to me. So I just want to say, don't worry, the podcast goes on next Monday. It's just going to be me, your host, Leif Beaverson, Liberty Beebs, Liberty Champion, Austin Peterson, on the Freedom Watch here every single day, your home for economic freedom and personal liberty at thelibertarianrepublic.com.